All right. Welcome, everybody, to the Doomer Optimism Podcast. This is Anarcho-Contrarian, or AC for short, co-hosting here tonight with Jason Snyder. And we are here with Michael Thomas of Sharon. Michael is a homesteader, traditional Catholic, cider maker, father, family man, so on and so forth. And we hope to dive into many different topics here today. And of course, wanted to start with an introduction from you, Michael, for folks who aren't aware of you and your Twitter presence. Love to hear about you, your experience, your farm. We'll probably ask some leading questions as we get into it, but would like to start there if you don't mind. So take it away.
Yeah, I mean, you covered. Yeah, thanks for having me on, first off. So thanks, guys, both of you, for having me on. I appreciate the various, like, olive branches and dialogues that went back and forth before this. So that was nice. And I'm grateful to get the platform and talk to people and talk to you guys in particular. So, yeah, I'm a traditional Catholic, but born, cradle Catholic, but like many people, wandered in my early years, probably in the past like 6 or 7 years, found my way back to the faith and increased in that trajectory, in the depth of that trajectory over the past couple of years. And so that's, first foremost. And then I am, I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a cider maker, so I have a small kind of just on the border of like commercial scale orchard, and I've integrated a lot of what would be considered like human scale techniques to the way that I manage my orchard. I consider myself like a traditionalist in practice, from cider making to the way that like I order my life and my family, and the way that I the way that I practice like my agricultural practice. So the thread of traditionalism and in my Catholicism. So that thread of traditionalism kind of weaves its way through all those things. And yeah, I've been maybe 10 years on like the homesteading path, although come from a lot of other stuff that like related things, there was recently a Paul King's North article, if you guys caught it, where he talks about the trajectory of the anti-globalization kind of orientation over the past 15 years. And I follow a very similar, orientation in my kind of narrative and understanding in the world. So in the early 2000s, late 90s, I was very much involved in the, anti-globalization world, from I would have considered like probably like an anarchist style perspective. And then that position of anti-globalism eventually matures in me and develops through various experiences and becomes grounded in what I understand now and what I always think it was grounded in, but what I understand now is like a deep reactionary politic that incorporates traditionalism and my Catholicism as that kind of counterpoint to modernism. And so that's like a really nutshell way to understand me and my trajectory history with everything from agriculture to faith to politics to everything else.
What brought you, Mike? What brought you to your current place? Talk to us about going from that position to wanting to be a homesteader to being on the land.
Yeah. So 10 years ago, yeah. And all those things that I just explained, I'm kind of like going rapid speed, but all those things are intermeshed with one another and like, kind of interesting ways that every time I tell my story, right, every time we tell our story, we kind of like reinvent ourselves and our understanding of ourselves. And so every time I'm like revealed, oh yeah, that's another way that these things connect. But I was actually initially, it was just cider making. I was making cider with a buddy of mine. We had had some various like small business successes and a small business at the time that meshed well with a piece of agricultural property. I had a hobby of cider making, and I was like, well, if we're going to get this farm to, follow, the needs of our other small business, why don't we use all that land and plant apple trees on it? And I was I came to a cusp in my cider making where I realized like, it wasn't, if I really wanted to make a very good cider, I had to control the fruit that was going into it. It was really the fruit, the apple makes cider. I was becoming more and more traditionalist with cider making in terms of like paying attention and dialing in on varietals and limiting things out of the, you know, eliminating things from the process. So no yeast pitches, natural fermentation, you know, oak tanks, no pressure, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so, and so that process of cider making eventually was like, okay, I got to plant an orchard. So it was really like a business idea that brought me out to the landscape. But then as that continued to develop and homesteading kind of like a human scale agriculture began to develop, with that orientation of like traditionalist cider making, an intense personal kind of revelation return with a V happened in me that that I was like, oh, these things relate to one another. You know, what I experienced in my refusal to accept my resistance to the ideas of like global technocratic consolidation or whatever else, those really related to like human scale agriculture. Like there's like a big overlap there. And so I got blessed with this period where I was just kind of like on my farm. The business we were running was on farm. I got like a good chunk, like 6 years, maybe 7 years, where I was just on farm planting trees. Had a deep kind of meditation process and practice. And I would sit with, like in a small oak grove and just kind of meditate every day, think about different things. And then I had a lot of time to read. So it's like really just like, you know, I separated myself from society and I prayed and I worked, you know, and I read and I prayed and I worked and I read and I prayed and I worked and I read. And much, you know, so for the Catholics who are listening, you're gonna see that this, the Benedict pattern, that, you know, St. Benedict's pattern in that experience. And so, in that meditation, prayer arose from prayer. It was like, okay, well, what form? And I went back to the prayers of my grandmother, who was a Catholic. And, you know, I can talk a lot about like my return to Catholicism, but ultimately it spread out over like many different realms of like, I'm intellectually reading things about agriculture. I started where everyone started, I read Grandpa Barry and then I kind of slowly worked my way backwards, right? So you get Barry, and then you get the Southern agrarians, and then you get like, you know, into the appropriate technology people or the Greers and the, you know, the fringe kind of like, post-oil people and stuff like that. And then further after you get that, you get to small is beautiful, right? And you get to like I forget what school that is, in any event, but got to those guys. And then that take took me back to, after that, it's the scale fellow, Leo, I forget what his name is, but he reduces everything to scale. He was, the guy who wrote Small is Beautiful. He was his teacher.
Oh no.
Schumacher's teacher. I forget. Anyway, he addresses that, like the chief issue in politics is scale. And then so the, which is really right, subsidiarity in Catholic. And then from there, I get to Catholic theology, where all that stuff is all coming from, or rather Catholic social teaching. Mm-hmm. Pope Leo XIII, which is a nice segue to distributism eventually. But I get to Catholic social teaching. And so there's this intellectual trajectory of like reading, working all day and praying, you know, so that takes me back in each one of those realms, takes me back to the roots of my Catholicism, to the faith of my ancestors. And so they all kind of converge. I'm also reading a lot of like classics and stuff, you know, and again, I got blessed with this period of grace where I could just like do this kind of stuff, just like read a lot and work a lot. And eventually I see the Trinity in the landscape, you know, first in the kind of mystery of God, the perception of God that I think is like more classical. All things arise and end in mystery. And then I see a type of like force and presence on the landscape, that's like moving all things. There's like a force behind things that's moving all things. And I feel deeply connected with trees and grafting and growing fruit, right? And so there's this movement, there's this life force, right? The Holy Spirit. And then eventually in a meditation session with like I would play these games where you would context my meditations in like different ways or contemplative times, whatever, however you want to call them. And one game I played one time, I was like, well, what is this oak tree feeling? If I was the tree, what would I feel like? And so I sat in witness of the tree for a long while. And I see the tree's like roots are being eaten by funguses and the branches are half dead. And there's squirrels hiding nuts in it, digging holes in it. And if I was the tree, I'd be in massive amounts of pain, you know, just an intense amount of pain and suffering if I was the tree. But then from that, this beautiful like life is pouring into the world. Right. And then boom, Christ. And I'm just like, oh, right. This is all real. The faith of my ancestors is real. There was something there. And then so that was really my like intellectual moment of like going back to it. And then the practice. Right. At that point, I'd been praying like, you know, Ave Maria's in Latin because that's the only prayer I knew from my grandma for a year while I garden or plant trees or whatever else. And so everything just kind of went like at that point.
It's funny. It's funny you say that. I have a similarly the mentioning of the oak tree reminded me. You know, I'm not a particularly religious person, but I am religious curious, I would say. And we have a strong Quaker presence, believe it or not, locally to where I am. And I attended a few Quaker meetings just out of curiosity. You know, it's silent hour, and you know, a lot of meditation, reflection. You know, I look outside and there's an oak tree, an old ancient oak tree tapping against these large windows. You know, and I asked myself, like, what do I know of God? And I was coming up blank. And then, you know, I look at this oak tree and what does the oak tree know of God? And the thing that came to me was like, God is cyclical. Like the oak tree knows the cycles of the year. And sort of that made me think of like resurrection and rebirth. And, you know, So that's like a funny little tangent to come back to this question. You know, what is the cycles look like for you and your farm? Like, can you describe, you know, an annual cycle and like not only in physically, what do you do on the farm throughout the seasons, but also like how do you tie your faith into that as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, as a Catholic, right, we have the liturgical calendar.
Sure.
You know, and the deeper I got into my Catholicism, the more I realized that I wasn't the first fella to have these revelations, you know, and that there'd been lots of people before me who had a lot of these revelations and deep, you know, deep thinking and stuff. And so as I left my ego behind in the process and stopped worrying about so much of like my you know, personal spiritual journey or whatever, and more realized that there was like I had a place in a long history of a story, and that I actually had a responsibility to it. And so that's the same thing with the cyclical nature of the farm, or like the jobs in the farm. It's like our place is often delineated by our responsibilities. Right. If you take a real look at the way that you commune with the world and really break it down, what you'll find is really intense points of responsibility, how we eat, how we get our way, how we get our fuel, you know, this relationship of communion that is necessitated by our existence is not just a it's not just like a one way street of us taking. There's also like a give, if you're to be truly receptive and to be living in like gratitude with what you're doing, if you're willing to exercise true dominion and stewardship over something, you take care of it. Right. And so, seasonally, that place looks a lot different on my farm from like season to season. Just like it looks different in the liturgical year. So where should I start? Let's start in springtime. So I could probably go like around this loop like a bunch of times, but like springtime, I lay out the garden. Let's start with the garden. I lay out the garden. I increasingly year after year after year, I'm getting closer and closer to no-till. Seemed like a dream. But now I kind of have enough organic cycling on my property that like I actually see it as a possibility now, where I used to feel like it was just like, how do you even do that, you know, like what are you, like you must be importing like thousands of dollars worth of compost, and now I'm finally like not built up or get an organic cycle on my farm where I can see it a little bit. But in years past, I've pushed a wheel hoe a ton. You know, I used to have equipment. I've scaled away and done, I do everything at human scale. So I do everything with like my hands. I had a hand for a couple of years at draft agriculture. So I did things with horses for a little while, but now I didn't let that go. It's just me, and my kids and my wife, and like the energy of our bodies and that are put into the process and the energy of the landscape. And so kind of like no-till, like Ruth Stout kind of gardens. I think all my row crops will eventually end up no-till, like Ruth Stout kind of gardens. This year I added some boxes. So now I'm starting to do boxes, and I'll probably do the annuals in boxes, you know, some of like my tomatoes and peppers and getting all that. So every year I kind of like learn a little more about my garden. Then there's tree planting. Actually, kind of before that is tree planting, which I move all my hedges around. I don't really buy or import anything anymore. It's like I'm growing apples from seed, or I'm transplanting, you know, some tree from one hedge to another hedge. This past year, it's been a lot of locusts, black locusts and maples and poplars. Those are like my three favorite hedge trees right now. So that's really what I've been doing. In past years, it's been tons of fruit tree planting, you know, just tons and tons and tons of apple tree planting. And I can get into that whole cycle, which is a whole other thing. So you get leaf spring and haymaking starts in the end of May, June, you know, once the grass gets heavy enough to fall over the scythe. So I'll start scything at that point. I try and get like an hour in every day. I don't really make it, but I try. But I get an hour in, a cutting and raking in June. And then July usually tends to be like a funny break time where I avoid weeding and like, you know, I kind of focus on like rotating sheep and stuff. All right. So I said I could go around this wheel like 1,000 times and I'd come up with like all these other things that happened. So yeah, sheep, all the yep. sheep lambing, you know, my sheep kind of lamb early. So my sheep are lambing like almost pre-spring at the end of winter. But this now I'm turning them out to fields, which includes fence repair, gate repair, you know, all that stuff. That
kind of how many head of sheep?
Oh, I only have 15. I've swelled to like, I think the highest was like 23 at one point, but like usually I keep it around like a dozen is what is the, you know, is the goal. My whole sheep process is like no additives. So it's all grass, no grain.
So you're putting the hay up a good portion of it. Yep.
Yeah. In years past, I put most of it up. I always end up kind of like buying a cart out of like nervousness, 'cause I don't want to like, you know, but if push came to shove, I could definitely scythe all my hay. Mm-hmm. I get pretty close, but then I always buy a cart to be like, let's be good to the girls. So then August starts harvests of various sorts. I mean, all the greens and stuff, right? They're just like constantly harvested. But you get into other harvests in August. Usually there's like a work project in there. I'll build something, fix something, make something in the summertime. And then I'm still rotating animals all this time, which is like a once a day thing, watering them, chickens, geese, regular homestead kind of stuff, everything at like a homestead level. And then September rolls around, and by the end of September, I'm like cleaning up, getting ready for the cider making season. So October, I'll start collecting fruit usually. End of September, I'll start collecting fruit. Maybe fourth week of October. Every on the weekends, I'll press cider. Cider goes, you know, there's prep. Like 2 weekends ago, I cleaned up the whole cider house, you know. And then cider.
How much cider do you produce? I don't know how it's measured. Forgive me. Bottles or barrels or whatever. But on average.
I only ferment in 59-gallon wooden, like, oak barrels, and I usually put up, like, 3 to 5 a year, you know. Mm-hmm. This year, I'm only going to put up one because I have 3 from last year that I didn't bottle that are, like, still pretty good. So I'm only going to put up one, and this year is almost even just, like, the performance of a ritual more than it's, like, I need cider. I have plenty of cider to trade. I have plenty of cider to drink. I just, like, it's more like just, like, this is a ritual. You know, this is what I do. So then cider sits, You get into the holidays at that point, and it gets into the heating season. So somewhere in there, there was stacking wood. Somewhere in that, now there's the maintenance, the daily wood task. You know,
and you're in the process of, if I remember correctly, sort of approaching a more low carbon from a utility standpoint situation for your home, in terms of you bought a really nice wood cook stove.
Yes.
Trying to disconnect more from the grid. You want to maybe talk a little bit about that?
So I don't, I think a lot of the duality that modernity has set up in the terms of like the physical and the other spheres of the world, the spiritual sphere, everything, that distinct line is not so clear that the modern mind like interprets it as. And so technology, for me, like incorporates a lot of the errors of modernity, I'm happy to get into. The increasingly high levels of technology are increasingly an expression of man's, of like a faith in man's agency over a faith in ultimately God or natural law, these types of ideas. And so with that, and you know, that's just like a cascading error, but technology is like the physical embodiment of that error. And so as we get more agency, somehow, Greer talks about this in a nice way. The more technological agency we apply to a problem, we begin to create the inverse of the solution we're looking to see, right? You get to like a point where you're actually creating the problem even more profoundly. And so in any event, I have a pretty anti-tech, kind of understanding that technology, like all things, needs to reach a limit at some point. That it can't just be like a limitless thing. It can't just be it just can't keep going forever and ever and ever. There has to be a point where you say enough. I believe that point is behind us, somewhere around like the combustion engine and electricity. I think intuitively most of us know this. It's where the Amish set it on a very different metric of like putting the communal over the individual, right? And they said most Amish communities, with that metric and context, kind of determine the same point. You know, no combustion engine and no electricity. And so, all of the solutions that we come to try and like incorporate in our farm, where we're making like homesteading investments into our farm, all of those investments that we make are often not like a reduction in technological agency rather than an increase. And so a lot of the rhetoric that goes around homesteading circles, there's some people are like, they're like engineering their homestead for efficiency and high production. And, you know, there's all these, I'm not necessarily like working in the way that I homestead on those same ideas of about like efficiency and stuff. You know, I'm more focusing on like beauty and the experience and responsibility inherent in communion and the restoration of tradition, which a lot of times determines like inefficient moves, and lower tech solutions. And so like, you know, hand pump water wells, you know, we don't invest in solar. We invest in like candelabras and wall sconces. And we're just like, it's like totally just a different orientation. You know, it's funny. There's like this funny overlap with me and like the prepping community. I think I'm motivated a lot to do things like out of a sense of like a Dostoevsky style, like beauty will save the world. And it has this funny overlap with like the doomy prepper community, where I'm like doing all the same things that they're doing, but for seemingly from a different motivated point. Although I do believe like in the collapse and failure of modernity quite obviously. But so all of our improvements are like that, right? They're like lower tech solutions that to solve those problems. We are often looking backwards and acting in a retrograde manner to solve problems rather than a progressive you know, looking forward to some technological savior, increase of my agency, but actually a reduction of my agency, or an acceptance of a more humble position, is actually the solutions that I'm often driving for.
I want to ask you about like just time management, because I know you work full time. Is that right? And I think a lot of people, when they look at homesteading, they think that they think it's too hard, you know, in kind of the modern world where we have to kind of have full-time jobs that don't directly relate to our homestead or the crafts that we're producing on our homestead. You know, it's more to bring in an income. And I also, you recently tweeted about how there are some kinds of regulations on your farm where it's like you wish you could just kind of sell your cider, right? And you know, kind of devote yourself more full time to this. But you know, because we're still within, you know, modernity, we're still within society, it makes it difficult. So do you want to talk about like the challenges you face of like, you know, one, just time management, energy, but also, you know, I guess what are some practical things that like, you know, if the government, you know, if dumb regulations would just go away, like it would allow me to actually, you know, have more comprehensive focus of what I want, you know, what I want to develop in my life.
Yep. I mean, we're all, but much modernity is wrapped up in the sin of usury. And so, right, we all, many of us have like debts, you know, or don't necessarily outright own our property, and have been kind of acculturated into a system that like, that's just the norm. That's how things work. And so as I made my progression out, right, of modernity, you have to kind of like, from my Catholic perspective, I've realized that, right, this is the whole modern process is kind of like a fall from a more graceful pattern. And so they're often like the things that you're challenging, pride, usury, the those items that you're challenge, you have to like unravel your own self from those sins. And sometimes that's like painful. Maybe it won't happen in one generation, you know, back to the humility thing. So to answer your question more directly about time management, I do wake up early, you know. I try and utilize my time as best as possible. I think some people who are used to like modern standards and integrate machinery and best practice and got their Cornell book, you know, in their pocket or whatever it is, would look at my farm and be like, wow, this is like messy, you know, like you're messy, you know, this is messy, you know, you know, your cabbage has got beetles or whatever, you know, whatever it is, you know, so, you know, I do what I can while I can, and I'm grateful for the time that I get. I'm very grateful for my work. With time management, I do. It's hard to find time for everything, you know. And I was just saying to Jen, that's why I think I just said to you guys a couple of minutes ago, I put up 5 barrels of cider last year. I bottled 2 of them. I didn't get to bottle the other day. I just could never figure out how to find the time, you know. I got 2 pastures right now that I can't rotate my sheep in because I just need like a whole weekend to put the fence back together, you know, and I just don't have that time, you know. This year has been really, really interesting where with the start of the whole Catholic land movement, I put a lot of time into organizing the conference, and you know, more so as the conference concluded. Now there's chapters starting everywhere and there's all kinds of work to be done. And so, so all that being said though, it's not a complaint. I think I find time, Jason. I do find and make time, and just, you find time, you know, if you want to do something, you cut out all the other bullshit and you manage your time effectively and you do it, you know, you do that thing and you stop making excuses, you know, you look at yourself and you're like, stop making an excuse about why you didn't get to that thing. You didn't get to that thing because, you know,
yeah,
because you didn't want to. Why didn't you want to, you know? So we're given quite a bit of time, you know. I make it to Mass every Sunday, and you know, and I you know, work 10 hours a day and I manage tons of stuff and had five kids and, you know, but still made cabbage out of my, I still made coleslaw out of my garden 2 days ago. I'll still put up cider this year. I'll still transplant trees out of the hedgerow. I'll still, you know, and so people stress themselves out with standards. One thing I've with like homesteading people, especially like the presentation stress that the networks create, you know, where you the Instagram world kind of thing, where people who are homesteading, I think Barry writes about this and I kind of love it too. So people who are homesteading, it starts off often as like a daydream. And it's like, when I get to my homestead, I'm going to be this kind of person, you know, it's going to change my life in this particular way. And then some of them get to their homestead and they're still there. They are, you know, they're still them. There they are at their homestead, you know? And they find that reality like really, really challenging. And so they stress themselves out with like projects. And then the failure at projects is like a reflection of their own failure and blah, blah. Every time I fail, you know, I put it under, I don't carry it on my back. I put it under me and I stand on it, you know? And so that process of, I think anybody who's even moderately long-term in agriculture gets pretty used to like attrition and failure as an acceptable part of the process. And so, you know, I've had a lot of failures, you know, I've tried to catch this darn swarm of bees like three times. It's split and I haven't caught any one of my dead kids. I've soaked boards and sugar water. I've, you know, done like a million different things to try and figure it out. And I just keep on failing, you know, but each time I'm trying to assess what I was doing, change my pattern, you know, do something new and whatever. So those would be my two things, is that, you know, you find time if you want to find time, you make excuses if you want to make excuses. So that's one. And then two would be, you know, I fail and I'm messy and I don't find time sometimes, you know? So.
Yeah.
You mentioned Catholic Land Movement and your conference. I'd like to transition there if we can, and just starting with maybe a recap of Catholic Land Movement 101. You know, tell us about the history, tell us about what happened to it, and what called on you to resurrect it. What does your version of it look like? So let's start at the beginning.
Okay. I kind of already gave my outline of like how I moved towards Catholicism and
sure,
part of that intellectual process of like reading Catholic social teaching and being like, whoa, subsidiarity is like really smart. Oh, the counter-revolutionary counterpoints to modernity are really well-developed and smart, you know? the moral teachings of Catholicism are like, you know, really clever. And I did fall into the trap for a while of being like, this is all so cleverly designed to create a nice, you know, society, you know, look at how they've codified all these long-standing traditions into Catholic social teaching after long discernments. Look at how nice a society would run. But really, it all works because the base of it is true. You know, Jesus Christ came and redeemed us, and the Catholic Church carries that redemption through the sacraments, and from that flows the truth, and it flows right through and out Catholic social teaching. And so, it's not a clever, you know, it's what is it? It's clever because it's true. It's not true because it's clever. So I want to make that clear. So I think I said that right. If I did said it wrong, fix it for me or forgive me. But in any event, so the Catholic Land Movement was industrialism happened. Industrialism happened and it destroyed sustenance agriculture in many parts of the world, and it consolidated people into cities, and World War I happens to further kind of like destroy the old order of things, raise all these national republics. I would argue that whole process was a way for people to create international markets and like commodify resources, forests, coal mines, whatever it is, right? They're creating an international standard of trade, and the destruction of the old monarchies and the kind of like Byzantine way that everything worked, and the spiritual resonance of places. You know, you're not going to clear cut your forest if that's the forest that your like blood and body is bonded to through a line of heredity that's connected to like a people that you identify with. You don't clear cut that forest and turn it into a resource. But you do if you're a nation state looking to, you know, increase production to feed a citizen, right? You do then. And so industrialism happened, and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race from the get-go. And there was a reaction to it, right? There was a really intense reaction to it. That reaction took a lot of different shapes. You know, I would, the subject that rouses people up. You know, I would see like communism, the errors of the Soviet Union, as like a failed reaction to industrialism, right? That's what it was. That failure was witnessed by Catholics, and the consequences of that failure was witnessed by Catholics, and the consequences of industrialism. And so Pope Pius XIII wrote an encyclical kind of addressing this. And from that encyclical, he kind of talks about a lot of the things that I've already touched on, about the relationship to the landscape, about gods, about dominion and the responsibility therein, about he takes like a very anti-Malthusian type of stance where he's like, you know, God left us all enough here and we need to understand how to steward it correctly. And introduces like a couple principles around like how, you know, nation states shouldn't get in the way of people providing for themselves on the land in which they reside. You're right. We shouldn't like inhibit someone's ability to like grow food or procure clean water like right where they live. And if we are, then your society's like broken. The government is like unjust. And so. From that, a series of like condensed principles, right? That the thinkers of the time like read this and were like, you know, we're with us. We see what the error in the Soviet, you know, in Russia. We see the error there and what it's caused, you know, and how terrible it is. We see, you know, how World War I and industrialism has like ravaged, you know, the European continent. And so what is like an alternative to those two things? And we see how capitalism is not sustainable in its like, you know, constant commodification and consolidation, right? Capitalism always consolidates wealth into various like nodes. And by consolidate, you get monopolies, and then you need stronger and stronger and stronger government agency to break up and regulate those monopolies. And then those monopolies in turn, through the power of democracy and democratic republics, like manipulate the government to their bit. So it's like a mess of a system that isn't really, you lose sight of like taking care of people, right?
What about fascism, leading up to?
Well, that's 20 years down the road. Let's get the we'll get to fascism.
You mentioned capitalism, and you mentioned the errors of the Soviet Union.
So 20 years, right? So I'm going, the progression in time is like, right, the 1930s, we get to fascism, and I want to get there because it's important. To continue, Chesterton and Belloc, take that encyclical, read it, bust out these principles, call it distributism, with the idea that widely distributed private property and the traditions necessary to make it productive, and a society that cultivates that, is like a well-ordered and good society. So they didn't like set up a system of governance or an order or a revolutionary pattern or anything like that. It was more like a lens from which to evaluate social order. It was not like a, you know, you could have a distributist monarchy, you could have a distributist democracy, you could have industry, you know, it's a policy lens from which to view, is your society like well ordering itself? And so as we've seen over the past couple of days, there was all this dialogue and misunderstandings and arguing and all this stuff around it, until finally the English distributists say, under the banner of like Father Vincent McNabb and a couple other priests and thinkers and agrarians, are like, we need to put these principles into action. What does that action look like? That action became the Catholic Land Movement. And so the Catholic Land Movement was a series of like vocational schools, programs that helped Catholics like get out to rural property and own rural property, like a working between with the laity and the hierarchy, the Catholic hierarchy, to like cultivate place around parish communities and the people's, you know, ownership of property. However, it was small. There was like 10,000 families, I think, that did it in England. Meanwhile, communism is still raging on one side, and then the capitalism of, and the industrialism on the other world is still raging on the other side. You know, the liberal capitalism, much like the order that we live under today, was raging on the other side. And then you have the consequences of those things reaching a crescendo in Germany, and people kind of revolt against the liberal order in Germany, and you get fascism. So here comes fascism. And you know, fascism arises and crashes Europe into war again. Fascism is defined by a lot of people a lot of different ways, but right, it's the merger of corporate and political power into like a system. There's a lot of different elements to it, but that's essentially what it is, into like a controlled nationalistic system. You know, the Nazis themselves are fascists, but they, you know, they're socialists under their socialized system. So again, but it's another like reaction, right? It's a reaction to the failure of liberal modernity. It's a reaction to the failure of industrialism for the German people, and it gets completely out of control and torches the world, you know, and is horrific for like many, many, many people. And that rages for another 10, whatever it is, 10, 15 years, kind of making a mess. And so, to speed it up to now, you know, and then we have the kind of like post-war period of space age, you know, technological saviors and
capitalism won, right? It won all that stuff. Capitalism world champion.
but everybody called it right. Capitalism doesn't really win, does it? Right?
We're
suffering the consequences of that right now. And so we can see that there is again now another consolidation of global power into like a type of technocratic regime that has kind of seized lots of various like republics across the world by the power of this thing is like a propaganda machine like unknown before. And so, you know, as we witness with like, I mean, we can't, are you guys going on YouTube with this?
Yeah. Just a recording. Yep.
This will go on YouTube. All right. I won't mention COVID. So you gotta be deft at how you say things. Right. So we're seeing a similar consolidation of power, politics, money that people saw during the industrial period. From the industrial period, we get a bunch of different reactions. Communism, fascism, liberal capitalism, technocratic capitalism. And in the whole mess of all those things, there was a small group of English distributists who identified with the Catholic Land Movement, who rejected modernism by grounding themselves in the Catholic faith, rejected liberalism by saying like small place and subsidiarity and like the definitions and form of small place matter, who grounded themselves in like simple work and prayer and community and history and craft traditions, right? In order to make a piece of property productive, you need those craft traditions. And so I see right now, and I think you guys probably witnessed it too online as part of the dialogue that's been going on the last little bit, that on many fronts, right, there's this resurgence of a reactionary ethos that has the potential, whether it's communism or fascism or whatever it is, to be very bad, to be very, very bad. And so there has to, and the pluralistic, like, let's all get along, you know, liberalism isn't going to work either. That descends into fascism eventually, just of a different sort, right? That's what we have now with the, the technocratic regime that is developed from that is totalitarian in its own rights. And so I believe that, however small and humble it may be, that the Catholic Land Movement offers a path for folks to understand why the reactionary ethos is rising and have a healthy and a good response to it. And so I believe in it deeply. And the more that I talk about it and the more that that I do with it with other people, right? It's all really focused on doing. McNabb, who's the priest I talked about, who's really one of the founding people, has this beautiful quote of just like, you know, as distributists or as the Catholic Land Movement, we mustn't talk. We have to do things. You know, we have to do things together. So there's chapters starting all over the country and really actually all over the world now. And it's all the workshops aren't about picking up experts or anything. The workshops are about doing work together, like actual workshops. You know, you go and like build shelving together, however you guys know how to do it. You go and can your vegetables together. You go and then collecting information from those things about like what works, what's the best form and practice. And then rejecting, utilizing the wisdom of the teachings of the Catholic Church to kind of organize the whole thing. So like, contrary to the like anarcho tyranny of modernity, you know, like hierarchy's good, actually. You know, the whole world is ordered in a hierarchical way, and it's good. And it's just to be humble and obedient to natural law and, you know, all these other forces that are flowing through the human experience in our world. And so, through and by the grace of God. Right. So that's the Catholic Land Movement. So I've been working on it with other people for like maybe like a year or two. I've been reading this stuff for like years and years and years. But I've been working on it with people for like maybe like a year or two, and it's absolutely flourishing and blossoming.
So you just had your conference. It was in the end of August, over the course of the weekend. And you mentioned, you know, it seems to be gaining momentum and there's almost more work coming out of it than there was going into it. Just can you give us an idea of you know, some of the practical momentum that's being built?
Yeah, well, there's like all these different people who are interested in different things. And so I tend to be like the hub that is trying to put order and form to the various, myself, my wife, and a couple other people who are close to us in like a smaller circle are trying to like put form to the energy that people are bringing to the project. So, you know, right now is really about like, what does it mean to be a chapter? How do you formalize the chapter process? So what does like a formal like hub organization look like? What's the defined mission for that organization? Outside of like just parish stuff, there's been really interesting, you know, the nitty gritty of, to the terms of property, the Catholic Church is the largest property owner in the world. And there's lots of aging monasteries that are not seeing new members. What happens there? You know, is there opportunities for young Catholics to, you know, farm or connect with those communities? There's been interest on both sides of that from holy orders to laity. And so what does Catholic community, like a couple people bought farms around here after the conference and are like moving to like be part of a community. I don't see that as necessarily part of the Catholic Land Movement work. It's just like, this is a community that's happening, but how does the Catholic Land Movement like inform that process? Right. So if people do want to start a community, like what would the Catholic Land Movement, like, you know, again, just order, form, hierarchy, creating process, recording what's happening, you know, establishing traditions, whether it's a conference tradition or whatever it is, and also doing, practice, always keeping at the center of it the truth of you know, Christ carried in the sacraments of the Catholic Church. And so
and the church is supportive. They've been supportive.
I mean, the church is so like big, you know. It's like But tons of priests love what we're doing and have been a part of it. Holy orders. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, I don't have a certificate from the Vatican.
Well, yeah. not there yet.
But it's good. You know, I can say that what I've seen is good and it's been received well by lots of people with lots and lots of enthusiasm. And so, you know, I've been part of like other like community building type things. And oftentimes there becomes this, the kind of like be nice big tentism of pluralism invites and opens the door into destabilizing elements or conflicting moral foundations or contextual ideas about like ontological concepts of how the world works that informs people's kind of like participation. And eventually these forces like the group becomes successful and becomes like some type of it falls quickly into that liberal modern pattern of seizing more and more agency as like the terms of its success, and then just becomes like an organization and like an NGO or something that's just like beset with like careerists and academics and all these noodle heads that aren't necessarily sticking their hands in the dirt, and actually like building community. And so there we have it. Why does every community project not work? Every intentional community outside of like Finhorn or a couple, I don't even know. There's like a handful that like worked. Usually the handful that work have some type of like culty moral bedrock that like binds them together and like tons and tons of ritual. And like tradition and stuff. And so, I'm not looking to create a clever system. I'm just looking to follow, from the source of truth. And so the Catholic Land Movement kind of defeats all those things that would take apart like this work against like small scale community building by centering the truth of the Catholic faith in the middle of it, and then kind of applying all the various like Catholic social teaching, subsidiarity, distributism, anti-modernism, whatever, blah, 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 blah. And so, anti-liberalism, blah, 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 blah. It ropes in reactionaries, but turns them away from, the idea of like seizing fascist agency in a government or whatever, I don't know.
So just what comes to mind, right? So the Catholic Land Movement is the calling, right? Catholics go to the land, come back to the land. Distributism strikes me as, sort of the economic, you obviously have the religious ethos that's covered. Distributism is sort of the economic ethos that's paired with the Catholic Land Movement. And then subsidiarity is like the political ethos that sort of is coupled with the Catholic Land Movement. Do I have that right? I mean, is that generally right?
Yeah, I think that would be right. I would... that's an interesting way. I haven't like put it together in my brain, but it's like a lattice work in my brain to hold the different concepts that make sense, somewhat make sense to me. For me, I would say that the centering of the Catholic faith and the idea of like natural order. And when I say that, I don't mean like some like made up concept of natural order where like, I mean, literally the way like life flows through and into the world and ordering ourselves on that also instructs a type of anti-democratic, anti-republic, hereditary system. Although I would be like into a constitution, like the guaranteeing of some like basic community rights, but maybe not individual rights. But it's like getting into like messy political theory, and like it's almost like on an intellectual way, it's like an interesting discussion to have. But there's just like a massive amount of work to do. But before all that, who are we going to make king? But for me, there's that like how do we organize thing too. Hierarchy and patterns of natural order, understanding that the family is the smallest unit of society, I know you, I think Jason tweeted that recently, that you agree with us trads, that the family is the basic unit of society. And I was like, aha, he refutes all of liberalism. The right to, we're going to get
it. There was a second part of that.
Right. I can get to that second part too. But just in the recognition of the family as the smallest unit of society, you know, my next step would be like to get you to refute the human rights of the individual, you know, and that should be the rights of the family. I believe that that modernity is a type of inversion of natural order, and that it's antinatalist at its core, and the consequence of it in its like long-term eventuality is the destruction of all life. I think more people are beginning to see that, and they, you know, vaguely kind of call the technocrats, like, you know, Gnostics who are trying to destroy the world, you know. You know, you see this awareness kind of dawning on people, like progress to where kind of thing. So where was I going with that? I think that everybody naturally is, and you look at people intuitively, like you look at a child, like intuitively, like they get the concept of like family and natural order being like the core unit and organizing principle of society. And so if you kind of like golden ratio all of reality and you get the family in the middle, right, you get like a very different looking political organization on the outside, one that was more akin to conceptual, like, identities, people, nations, kings, queens, you know, the hereditary thing. And that fits well with distributism because, right, it's always strengthening, distributism's idea is always strengthening the rights. I think Belloc even says this right out in Restoration of Property, or maybe just like dances around it, but it's strengthening property rights, right? It's removing the secular power and agency from governments and just repeatedly strengthening private property rights, but doing it, and this is where I think it's so important that you include the Catholic morality, because if you do that constantly, but the basis is the liberal individual, you get a problematic thing happening. And so this is why I keep going back to like the family and the concept of the family being the smallest unit of society is very, very important to like all the other Catholic social teachings, all the other Catholic like moral base is really important to like make distributism functional. Distributism ended last time and became like went all over the place because there was a distributist congress that socialists and communists in like basically infiltrated and took it all over and made a mess of it, and nobody was interested in partaking in it anymore, and it ended. And distributism since then has had this like smear on that part of its history, so much so that the original people, Belloc and Chesterton, wanted to distance themselves from the term by the end of their lives. I think that's interesting in the context of the recent couple days dialogues that have been going on, and maybe illuminates a little bit like why I am the way that I am, you know, because how much distributism is related to a fundamental guiding principle of the Catholic land movement, and then to see it go down like almost the identical historical path that it went down before that culminated in its like
That discussion. So one of the things that I was trying to do in that discussion was and this is maybe me by nature, but like push both ways. There were people like, you know, distributism is a big tent. Everybody should be included so long as, you know, you agree on the mission being private property, productive private property rights, right? I was like, cool, that's great that everybody agrees on an economic ethos, but then you have, you know, sort of the moral ethos that if we do not agree on a moral ethos, how do we mitigate our moral disputes so we can get to work, because small scale distributed productive private property is a lot of work. takes a lot of work at the family level. It takes a lot of work at the community level. And, you know, I made, you know, offhand and maybe an off color joke, but like, you know, a lib land movement, it would be too focused on grievance disputes to like actually get the work done that's necessary, you know? And, you know, that was tongue in cheek, but maybe not so much.
I don't think so much.
So I was kind of pushing on one side, like, can you have a secular distributism? Like, if you agree on the economics, must you also agree on the moral aspect, cultural aspect, whatever you want to call it? Maybe yes, maybe no. I haven't figured that out for myself, you know, but I can say that, you know, part of my background in growing up, I would categorize as somewhat distributist, a very small town, you know, sort of agrarian town in New England. You know, definitely widely distributed, definitely productive private property, very secular, extremely secular, you know, and it's always has been since my great grandparents. And it works. It's a very cohesive community. Private property rights are respected. They are respected so much that you treat other people's land just like your own. And it's basically open access for all, because we're all taking care of each other's land. And so I asked myself, and I was kind of asking myself as I was arguing with people on Twitter, like, why did that work? And for me, you know, the reflection that I had is like, it was about the place. Like, it was about rootedness in place. And it was about multiple family units through multiple generations tied to that place. And that gets back to what you were saying before. Like, people don't clear cut their backyards if they're, you know, if they're dependent on firewood fuel to support the local community, right? They don't clear cut their backyards and send that to make particle boards for, you know, who knows what else. You know, not to say, you know, don't shit where you eat, but don't shit where you eat, right? And so I guess what I'm trying to say in the end, like, I agree there needs to be a moral an alignment in this small scale to get sort of the grievances out of the way, right? We agree on something, but the conclusion that I came at is like, you know, that something can also be place and love of place and not necessarily a moral foundation, you know, in based on religion. That's my position. I'm not entirely convinced, but I was like, maybe that'll work, you know.
Does that place still exist?
Yes, although, you know, of course, one of the things that I talk about a lot is, you know, the economic engine of, you know, technocratic liberal capitalism has sucked a lot of life out of it, right? You know, people like myself, frankly, left and didn't come back, right? And so the pull of modernity definitely has affected those places, to your point.
Right. And then to you know, the groundedness in place is good, but I look at a community strategy like an Amish community strategy, right? And that they're going to be here in another 100 years, you know, they're going to be here in another 200 years. But is that community that you love, will it be here under those pressures over the next 200 years? You know, the secular world, because of its kind of like, we could talk about like the mechanics, the social mechanics of it for a long time, but it's become quite toxic to the existence of like a healthy family unit. In terms of natural order, the boundlessness of like, well, what a family shape is. When I say family, I mean a man, a woman, married, having children.
Just to clarify the point I was making is, and I made this point later on in the thread, that I think the traditional family structure, and I would say hopefully not the nuclear family structure, but more of the extended family structure, will be the predominant mode. But I do think that life is messy, and that, you know, people have different inclinations, and other things can perhaps work as well. Maybe not. You know, other definitions of family, I guess, is what I'm saying. You know, whether it be, you know, same sex families, whether it be, you know, chosen families, however that's defined. You know, I think that to, you know, kind of go into the, you know, kind of go into the thought of, well, nothing else can work, you're actually you know, you're precluding kind of experiments and living. You're precluding kind of this evolutionary process where we see what is viable in a changing world. What is viable in a future that is not going to be like the past. That modernity, as we know, it might be going down, but the remnants of modernity are going to be with us for a long time. And what does that mean? What does it mean that we have more scientific knowledge than we did in the past? What does it mean that we will probably be repurposing a lot of technology that maybe isn't being produced anymore, right? What does it mean that, you know, we've gone through, you know, industrialization, the 20th century, you know, we've gone through the age of the computer and the internet. You know, I just think that to say that only one type of, you know, one type of family can work based on the past is just, it's not taking into account, you know, evolution. It's not taking into account how, you know, societies evolve, how cultures evolve, how ecosystems evolve even. So that's the point I'm making. Not to say that I don't think that, you know, kind of the traditional family as we're talking about, it won't be the predominant form. I think it will be, but I just don't want to close doors on, you know, people who want to try to form a life that makes sense to them under biophysical constraints. That's kind of the point I'm making. Anyway, go ahead. You can go. Yeah. You can just either. I don't know if we want to argue about this.
Not sure there'll be an agreement there.
Yeah. I don't think. I think just the way that I would respond to that is that you know, order again is like delineated by place and responsibility. And that a good society is going to flow from an order that orients itself towards natural order. And by that, I mean like the flow of life, right? You can't like plant a tree upside down or, you know, it won't grow, you know? And so there's less of like, right, free will ultimately, even as a Catholic, free will is the gift. We're free to like err and do, you know, people are, you know, free to, you know, but to endorse it or to say, you know, this is coming back to the moral bedrock of you know, Catholicism, where it's like the best way to orient a society is to orient it around natural order and the natural family being the family from which life springs, the union from which life springs, you know, the way the organisms come together. Is a good
nature also produces novelty as well. Produces novelty and it changes. It doesn't stay the same. You know, I just think this
preconception
of like what is natural order, you know, as we move forward in a, you know, completely different world. You know, I agree with your sentiments that I don't think industrial modernity is going to last. But you know, how, you know, what we look like coming out of it and what is natural order in vastly different environmental, sociocultural conditions. I don't think we can map out all of the potential variations of what it could actually work in different contexts.
Right. So it works in a very perceivable way. And so I guess I don't want to get to an end where we're just like, you know, it's somewhat delusional to think that life flows from any other type of patterning than that, you know, life flows through a very specific ordered pattern and a society that structures its traditions, its moral framework, its social framework around supporting the flow of that pattern in a good way, not prioritizing the outliers or the rights of the outliers or the existence of the outliers, but prioritizing that core pattern experienced by, you know, the majority of people and saying that pattern from which life flows, be this agriculture, the human condition, you know, whatever, the things that don't create like barren wastelands, the things that don't create, like a termination of that flow of natural energy, whatever you want to say, however you want to contextualizing your brain, that is like a very ordered, perceivable thing. to misunderstand it or to to delude society, shifting it from that cultivation of the traditions and the patterns that cultivate life is a mistake. To orient your society for other ideas like the agency of the rights or agency of man or whatever. These are all, I do think we're going to take something from modernity, Jason. I think we're going to take that it was a mistake, that the whole thing was like this giant mistake, and that we're like unraveling it in our brains through dialogues like this. And through, you know, practice that we're going to say.
Dialogues that are occurring through the internet, which is a product of modernity. So
of course,
So we're saying that we're using the tools of modernity to unwind the modernity, but
yes.
Say that we're going to return with the V, I just think is silly. Like, we're not going to return. Like, something is going to be fundamentally different.
We
understand what, you know, to think that we're going to return to this conception of what the past was like and what was good about it. And, you know, by the way, the conditions of the past planted the seeds of modernity itself. So for me, return is a much less useful concept than evolution. Like, we see that there's a whole lot wrong with modernity, but to throw it all out, throw baby bathwater, everything out without understanding that it happened for a reason, right? There were knots that, you know, were untied because that led to modernity, you know, through the previous orders. It's going to evolve, right? It's going to change. And for me, the point of, or, you know, I guess the point, you know, for me, the value of tradition and the value of kind of reviving tradition is we want to revive, you know, the lessons from history, and we want to take the things that we find really valuable, but we don't want to return, right? It's going to be some kind of synthesis.
See, I think that you're contextualizing the idea of return into like some type of utopianist project where some type of nostalgic utopianism where like there, everything was good. We really messed up and, you know, we're just going to wipe everything out and then it'll be good again. This was necessary or it wouldn't have happened, right? All of this that's going on. It's very sad that it's all happening. Yeah. And it informs a deeply important lesson to us that the things that we've placed faith in, again, like our agency or the spiraling lattice work of government structures or, you know, technology or all these things are actually empty. And that even in one another, you know, and that there is a core, a home in the human experience of making ourselves humble and obedient to a divine, a God, you know, from a God, God to God, at the center of things. And so the return would happen. The sweetest return is coming home again, you know? So it's a return to home, but not without the knowledge of your journey. Not without the knowledge of like what happened here. And I think what happened here, the lesson that all of this informs is that much of it and much of the things we placed our faith in were not a good thing to put our faith in. And they led us to really terrible ends.
I'm the last person to defend someone like Steven Pinker, but I don't think everything about modernity has been bad. And I think it's lazy thinking to say that everything about modernity has been bad.
The core organizing principles about the whole thing have been an absolute disaster for life on this planet. They've created an absolute disaster for life on this planet. And for the human experience,
we came across fossil fuels, if we hadn't come across fossil fuels, whatever system we had tried to implement with that much energy, you know, orders of magnitude more energy entering into the system, probably would have been a disaster for the planet. I mean, it's just third law of thermodynamics, some people say, is the maximum power principle. You have that power, you're going to use it and you're going to exploit. And
I don't agree. That's like a very kind of like materialist, assessment of like it all happened because we got that. We burned oil lamps for thousands of years before we actually took that oil and turned
not,
it.
Not at the scale that we were able to retrieve that oil.
No. But what I'm saying is that
technology to be able to utilize it.
Right. It was there though, and the technology to be able to utilize it was born from a pattern of thought about like the need to utilize that form of agency. You know, so people got wrapped up in their clever thinking instead of an acceptance of like a kind of humble stasis with the grace of God and natural order.
There's a similar argument that people make that, you know, the Industrial Revolution, they make a similar argument with the Industrial Revolution, but then they also make the same argument with the invention of agriculture. Right, 10,000 years ago or so. I'm not a short earther. I think that we evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. We are mainly horticultural societies and hunters for most of human history. And then we started cultivating the land for whatever reason, probably a stabilizing climate. The last ice age ended and we settled down. We built these empires that, you know, oftentimes were very
green anarchy. Yeah, we're gonna give me the Zerzan.
If you're gonna bring this argument about the Industrial Revolution and it wouldn't have happened if we had the right order, and you're saying we should have kept, you know, the agricultural revolution, you can make the same argument that, well, you know, your revolution is just equally as oppressive as, you know, the Industrial Revolution is to the, you know.
I think
you're picking and choosing which, you know, era of history you're finding that golden mean.
I'm informed by the bedrock. One of the things of modernism would be to accept like this type of like materialist assessment of history. And so, no, you're right. Like I concede, yes. I take a Catholic.
I haven't rejected all the modernism, so I can do that.
Yeah. I have a Catholic worldview. I don't, Christ came at a particular time. His place in time and history is very important and informing. He spoke much in agricultural metaphor and parable. He was God and man, and he offered us teachings to like redeem fall of grace, and those teachings are timeless, and they can inform us like right today. So, I don't know. I think that just puts me in like a funny position to like. There's like a rhetoric, there's always been a revolution, and there's always going to be a revolution. There's a story and a conclusion to humanity. You know,
yeah.
So I don't think it's just like this forever pattern like that. You know, I think we all have a very, 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 very important part to that story. It's like a special virtue that we've been given that like we have to perform, and it's terribly important that we perform it. But So I don't know. Relating my rhetorical form to like we should, you know, then we shouldn't have had any evolution or progress. You know, there's like an arc to this story. You know,
All I'm saying, and we don't have to keep going back and forth on this. All I'm saying is that one person's evolution or process is another person's disaster, right? And I understand that you're coming from a Catholic point of view, and you know, I'm not trying to argue about. I don't want to argue with you about that, but. I think for me, it informs kind of this broader conversation or this conversation we were having earlier about, you know, potential cultural forms that, you know, so I think of it two ways. There's going to be increasing biophysical constraints, and that's going to provide a lot of constraints on what cultural forms are viable, right? There's just, you know, to me that seems pretty clear. But I don't think we know what all the viable cultural forms would be. I think they'll mostly be localized, you know, localized communities that I think we all agree with. But to say that, you know, coming from your point of view, I can see why you say, no, there's actually one particular cultural form. But if you don't accept the premise, you know, all of the premises of Catholicism, then for me, it's just hard.
I don't see there being one particular cultural form. I mean, but culture is informed by the conditions of place, right? So like it's dependent on like the change of the seasons, the foods that you eat, the rhythms of the agriculture around you. These are the things that inform your culture, and you get your rituals and your music and all, you know, your colloquial kind of expressions of human society. So a diversity of culture and place is really, really important. But I do understand that any culture, like some cultures are better than others, because they adhere to a type of respect for the earth and for humanity. They aren't antinatalist. They don't mutilate or horrifically subjugate people. And those forms have... those various forms have like certain structures to them that are discernible. And yes, from my Catholic morale, you know, set, I can discern general principles,
right,
that lean towards like good cultural form. One of them being ordering your culture around the natural flow of life and play. Like
we've seen that throughout history through many different religious traditions. Many,
of course.
You know,
no, yeah, argument.
Yeah, and so, yeah, okay. I don't have any.
Yeah, I think obviously what we're coming up against is like how do you mitigate these differences? I mean, we're doing this in this conversation. Like, if we're living right now. Right now in technological modernity, in the age of social media, we are rarely having productive conversations. This is a very productive conversation in comparison to most conversations that are happening. Most of it is noise out there, and most of it is shit throwing, frankly, because the stakes are fairly low in terms of the physicality of it. You know, again, my experience is that when you are rolled up, your sleeves are rolled up, and you're working with your neighbors, there are different stakes. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, how can we coexist? Is there room to coexist? Like, you know, me personally,
you're dipping dangerously into pluralism here.
I mean, I believe.
I like it.
I believe that a certain amount of experimentation or a certain amount of variability in belief is acceptable, as long as one person is not imposing their will on another person or one community. Excuse me, I take a much more family-oriented, community-oriented than individualist standpoint. Like, as long as communities are not imposing their will on other communities. So, like, I feel very strongly that if there is a Catholic land movement and they want a series of towns and villages and they want to wall it off and that's theirs and they want to do, absolutely. And other side of things with certain caveats around my own personal morals, they should be allowed to have their community in whatever form they see fit too. And that's ultimately, honestly, not something we're going to figure out now. Talking about where the limits are, those limits are probably not best talked about here. They're probably talked about in a physical sense, in terms of where does my community stop and where does yours end, like in a very localist sense. Like, we are not going to figure this out until we're up against the fence from one side or the other. And
honestly, so in Appalachia, like, so where I live in Appalachia, you know, we have a lot of Baptists and we have a lot of hillbillies, you know, and I use that term lovingly. I'm an aspiring hillbilly. I'll never be one, but I'm an aspiring one nevertheless. And there's a lot of hippies and there's a lot of people who don't really, they're kind of a hillbilly hippie. And there's been this interesting fusion. There's still tension, cultural tension between those things. There's religious tension and everything, but people here have pretty much figured out how to get, like, localist type people, like localist oriented people have pretty much figured out how to get along. And because, you know, one, that there's just a common place-based sensibility of, you know, being close to the land, you know, love of wilderness, you know, love of hunting, love of growing food, you know, all of these things. And, you know, that kind of shared sensibility kind of covers over some of the differences, which, you know, the difference is, you know, people tend to leave each other alone, right? When it comes to how people order their families and other things, like, okay, like we'll work together on a crew, you know, we get along, and then we go home to our families and, you know, I'm going to go smoke weed and I'm going to go to church on Sunday type of thing. It seems to work.
I haven't found it to work.
Yeah, you're saying on what timeline? Probably, Mike, your argument would probably be on what does it work on, what timeline?
Yeah, what does not only that, but the I would find that, like, how would I say it? That there's the pluralism demands that, like, a one-sided concession, right? This type of, like, liberal kind of, like, everyone's invited in, and as long as we, you know, be nice to each other, there's, like, a one-sided concession to that. That has, like, an ever destabilizing effect on the center, and that eventually it doesn't work, and it doesn't work for the preservation of traditional patterns or place-based patterns. It ends up kind of pulling it apart.
Perhaps it won't work here, from what I've seen, But I don't know what will work. I don't know if the Catholic land movement in deep Southern Baptist country is going to work. This seems interesting. There's an interesting fusion here, and it might not work, or it might have to drastically change forms as, you know, we have biophysical, you know, collapse of our life support systems as we know it. But I want to see. You know, I want that kind of, you know, kind of diversity and selection from that diversity to occur.
I want to, can I back up one point to something you said?
Sure, please.
You said, you know, you want to always give people the freedom to, like, make their own choice and not, like, you know, you wouldn't infringe on the choice of anybody. Which I think there's this kind of, like, agoric sense of, like, you know, volunteerism is pervasive, like, in the liberal ethos, like, nobody should be ever, like, forced to do anything, and authoritarianism or hierarchy and structure are bad on all fronts. And, you know, every free individual should just be able to, like, choose whatever.
Yeah. I want to restake my ground there. I definitely, have come to my current political position through a libertarian path. Absolutely not a libertarian anymore. I feel that there is when I talk about community rights, family rights, community rights, much more than individual. But what I mean is, like, some sort of democratic majority more than the individual. Like, if you have a majority of people feel this way, that at a small scale, very important caveat, that at a small scale is more important than, like, I feel like I should be able to pollute my property and throw oil in the stream or what, you know what I'm trying to say? Like, I just the individual above all else.
It's the point that I'm getting to, you know.
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify.
No. I think your clarification points out what I'm trying to get to is that there's no, like, social order in and of itself as a definition of, like, limits and boundaries, permissions, responsibilities. And so this idea of liberalism, where, like, those limits and, you know, boundaries and everything else are, like, kind of, like, defined by the individual, and we should be, you know, ever accepting of everything. I mean, in the current gender discourse, we can see where that goes, right? It gets absolutely psychotic. It becomes a type of psychosis of like boundaryless, without a border there to define a center. There is no center, and so you end up with like this placelessness and, you know, ever expanding boundaries. And so the lesson, I believe, of, but back to kind of weave in another part of our conversation, is that place is delineated by responsibility, and responsibility is like an ordering of hierarchy. Who are you responsible for? Who are you responsible to? And that looks different, I think, than what like people, you know, normally conceive of as like hierarchy. They think like this very like, you know, I don't know what the association with, I'm so far from like the regular association with it, but like everyone has a place and a duty in like a good society or a good social order. Everyone has like a place and a responsibility and a duty within a hierarchy. And so this idea of like always opening up the bounds of a given social set to like incorporate like kind of like an anything goes is destabilizing, because the whole social unit like readjusts around that. And when we have a type of like cultural ethos that's just continually pushing transgression of boundaries, which is and the inversion, some of those boundary pushers are looking to like invert various forms of natural order or only serve their own agency or worship mammon or whatever it is, you open up the door to like very, very destabling elements to like small scale social order. And so I think we see in all long lasting traditional communities a type of like rigidity and well bordered exclusion. there's like an in and an out. And I believe that this is one of like the, back to like, what do we take from modernity? You know, this is one of the informing lessons of modernity, that it's not like modernity keeps on trying to find like we're going to have a conversation and eventually there'll be enough conversations that will reach some type of like pluralistic equilibrium that is that will help us like ascend to like a utopian ordered society. And that's not, I'm more kind of negotiating our brokenness in this world, that the limits and boundaries are necessary, because if we take them away, we destroy the center and kind of destroy place, and then destroy the cohesiveness of like various social units. So it's very contrary to, again, like back to me being a reactionary or a retrograde or whatever, you know, an anti-progressive type. There's too much, I believe, and I think modernity informs it if you're courageous and like willing enough to like level with yourself in a truthful way, that there's been too much of that border and boundary transgression, and that it's destabilized people, and it's severely hurt what our rightful place is, which is like to exercise our dominion as stewards of this world. It's born from that liberal ethos of like, we should have like a mutual, you know, this pluralistic, like we should have a respect for like anything, and that there's benefit in always like incorporating those outliers, and they weed themselves out, and then we get like a more honed system. And I don't really believe that that's the way it works. I believe that like parasitic elements of kind of brokenness kind of hijack the social order and create exactly what we've seen today. But if we were well-bordered, well-centered individual social units, we'd cultivate place much better. We would cultivate relationship with one another much better. It's not to say that those boundaries aren't permeable in some way. Again, like, you know, to golden ratio it, right? Like the structure of a cell or any other thing, like a social order must have form, or else it's not an order at all.
I don't disagree with that. I guess what I would add is, I definitely see ordered complexity, but I see it arising. I see it through an evolutionary lens, a cultural evolutionary lens, interacting with the land, with the place. And I see in modernity, we've just got so access to so much energy that, and you know, and we figured out the technology to harness that energy, that it blew kind of everything out of scale, you know, out of proportion, right? So for me, I think that nature itself will reimpose limits.
Yes.
Right. But you know, in this new kind of context we talked about before, we can't go back. You know, what new social arrangements, what new orders arise? I don't think we know. Just like, you know, before, you
there's
know,
a high likelihood they're going to look like the old ones that conform.
Perhaps, when nature placed limits on. But I don't know that for sure, and I'm not willing to conclude that before we actually see if that's the case. Because I think if we preclude that, it might, you know, many of the new cultural forms that look like will look very traditional and very similar, but I don't know if all of them will. And I think, you know, restricting that possibility ahead of time could be very violent, first of all.
Because it
could also be very damaging to just what is, you know, what is naturally evolving in this place to live within, you know, ecological boundaries and live with a certain degree of, you know, kind of cultural, you know, robust cultural health. I mean, just the fact that we've seen so much cultural diversity around the world, and cultural forms that have worked at a localized scale, you know, I think that there's going to be a new proliferation of something like that. And many of them will look like the traditional, you know, paths of the past, but I don't know if all of them are. And I don't know if I necessarily think all of them should, you know, unless that's just what takes place, you know, what is viable or not.
I would argue that that's the answer to the question. The answer to the question is a return. And so to like entertain the outliers is like the key. It's almost like, depending on your own agency of discernment, in what I would identify as like a self-possessed arrogance, right? For that individual to be like, well, like, who am I to judge? You know, like, well, I have no idea, you know. It's almost like this delusional, like aloof rejection of what is like clearly in front of us. Like,
I know what's clearly in front of me in my cultural context. And, you know, I've already described it. And it might not work out long term. You know, that's a hypothesis that will be tested. And we'll see. I'm going to put my energy into trying to be as constructive as I can to, you know, promote good values, all of the things that I think we would all want out of a community.
I don't know. We have to get to what I think that's what we're actually having a discussion about, is what is good values.
Right.
You know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we all have our sense of what are the good values. You take yours from, you know, you believe in this revelation. You know, I was a member of the Baha'i Faith, I was a very active member of the Baha'i Faith, and we also believed that there was a new revelation. And I'm sure that you probably would see that as a false prophet or antichrist, and perhaps it is. But I believe very strongly that, you know, it had a revealed set of values. I initially stopped believing that for various reasons. But so I understand where you're coming from. But I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of belief systems in the future, whether we like it or not. And if some of them aren't fit in an evolutionary sense, then they won't survive.
Yeah,
and maybe they're going to be proven completely correct.
I don't know if
that's a hypothesis. We'll see.
No disagreement for me on any of that.
Yeah, I think a couple things to clarify. I do not believe that one big tent is working. It's clearly not
separate
working.
Tent right? And
the totalitarian force again. Of capital and the culture that has ridden on its shorts shirt tails is not working, right? One giant, big, limitless tent, ever expanding tent, however you want to take that metaphor, is not working. I'm not convinced that one big Catholic tent would work. What I would like is multiple well-defined tents. Multiple well-defined tents with respectful borders. You know, ultimately, I believe that the morals that we will agree on, that we perhaps will have to agree on, given various collapse scenarios, is neighborliness. That perhaps is the thing that we could maybe all agree on here tonight. And if you're willing to do that, then I think we can wrap it up. We've been going for quite a while now. So if you are, at least I put that out there.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like this conversation has been an expression of neighborliness and, where I would choose to put myself forward in, like, in an evangelism sense is different than where I would put myself in organizing my community and who I want to, like, raise my family around. I would approach a different form of, like, plural acceptance by going outside of my community and evangelizing than I would accept in my community. You know, I understand the need, the benefit, the necessity to answer modernity with, like, nope, we need limits. Limits are good. We need centers. Centers are good. Hierarchy is good. A natural order exists and is good. Jesus Christ completes a Trinity and came as a man. He informs us and gave us sacraments, and there's order and form to all of that. And I have a responsibility to carry it. And these are my people carrying it with me, you know? But that way is, like, narrow, right? That the people who are going to fit in my tent are narrow. And I think that, it's important to bring that sense in that I think it's interesting that we were, like, we're all, I kind of felt like a loose agreement for a moment there, like, we just need a lot of different separate tents. You know, I would want to bring the truth of Christ and the Catholic sacraments into every one of those tents and watch them transform and grow around those truths. But the Catholic Church, even in and of itself, doesn't step in and, like, obliterate a culture. You know, it steps in and gives the gift of Christ, but there's tons of different liturgical forms. There's tons of different express, you know, there's Catholic churches from Africa to, you know, what it's the universalism, you know? And so, I guess the discussion of, like, necessary limits, though, and kind of the rejection of, like, earthly totalitarian forces, of which I would call liberalism one of them, is important. I think it's an important interjection, especially, and this is where, like, we get back to, like, the past couple of days, especially if people are picking up Catholic aspects of Catholic social teaching and putting them forth as, like, organizing principles. Someone has to knock on their door and say, this comes out of a whole nexus and matrix of thinking and a rich history that's been developed over many, many, many years of, and dialogues and lifetimes. And, like, you know, if you're going to take one part of it, well, you're opening the door, you're taking part of that tradition. You must be informed by the other elements of it.
We should have a DO conversation with Tradiste, at Account Tradiste, who's organizing the Distributist Conference. I saw you guys had some interaction.
He's a Catholic worker, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that would be interesting, because he definitely takes more of a, you know, we want to be inclusive approach. But he's clearly very faithful, and it would be an interesting discussion. And you can
to find out where you're
get to the truth, the heart of the matter.
Yeah. But I appreciate you guys inviting me on and hearing me. I know that I kind of ramble, so I'm sorry if I rambled at any point in this. And we went from like, you know, my own thinking into like a dialogue with one another that was, you know, that took a couple turns. So if I ramble at any point, please forgive me for my ramblings and, you know, all my
interesting ramblings. So I enjoyed your ramblings.
We're all guilty of it.
Yeah. Cheers. And sorry, I doxed you if I did at the end of this recording. I'm using names or whatever. I forget all the time what we're supposed to do. So I just get talking. So again, forgive me. Are you guys, how are you guys feeling?
Yeah, I think it's great. We covered a lot of ground. Do you have any last words?
No, thanks for coming on. I like you a lot more now than I did coming into it.
Do you understand?
frankly, my attitude earlier today coming into it was, this guy is a complete asshole. How am I going to do this?
I think you might find me a complete asshole at some junctions, you know. Yeah, I think,
but I see your humanity more now, and I don't just see your trolling online coupled with your, you know, with your pretty pictures of wood stacks and stuff.
Right.
I appreciate you more. As before, I just kind of felt like I hated you. So
right, I understand that. Do you see? I'd be interested in, like, after this experience with me and talking with me through some of these ideas and how, like, I've come to them and what they are. I'd be interested in, like, your read, going back and reading what you thought was maybe just like flippant or baseless trolling or whatever. And if you were to go back through and read me and see what you actually think about what I'm saying, you know, like, in the context, in the light of like the little bit of dialogue that we've had tonight, I'd be really interested in you going back and reading it and being like, oh wait, actually he's kind of saying, I think you'd find that I'm saying many of the same things. And much in like our first DM thing, and I won't get too into it, when we first DM'd, when I present the ideas of like rigid limits, or when I present the reality of like how evil communism was or whatever, you know, like I do it often online in a way that provokes, right? I threw that crap out there at the beginning of that thing, and it provoked an entire discussion about like proper limits for that conference, you know. And so there's different like rhetorical forms that work and provoke dialogue and discussion in different realms, and people might even have like a long dialogue like this with me, and if we were to like press on certain points, they'd be like, you're just an asshole, you know. So which is fine with me. I've been hated like a long time in many different places, like whatever, you know. But I just would be interested in like your read from like yesterday of being like, this guy's an asshole, to then meeting me now and talking me through some of the, you know, with me through some of like why I think the way that I do. Cause I think you fairly get me, you know, more or less. I'd be interested in what you thought about what I wrote after this conversation.
Yeah, I'll think about that. I mean, first thought, I think I understand kind of the intellectual and spiritual weight behind your comments, especially the ones that seem like more trolling or just more dickish, we'll say. I still don't necessarily like the style or approve of the style, especially in a format like Twitter. I think I would probably, you know, if I see that in the future, I'll be less, you know, quote unquote, triggered by it, because I understand kind of, again, you know, you've taken me through this journey that you went on. So I understand like the depth behind it and the reasoning behind it. You know, unless I fully converted to your point of view, I don't know if I would necessarily, you know, like that aspect of your personality online, but I'll understand it more and I'll be less triggered by it.
Yeah. Good. Okay. That's great. Yeah. Again, like there's like not right. So just in terms of our acculturation and like the way that we exist in contextually in the like social fabric right now, there is not a lot of propaganda or weight behind my various positions, but there is a massive amount of propaganda indoctrination, both within and outside of institutions, around the liberal framework of modernity. And so often when I approach this with people, I have to kind of like punch through it and push hard. And often I get that triggered response, you're a Nazi or whatever the heck they think I am. You know what I mean? And it, then this dialogue unfolds eventually, if they have the capacity and the competency and kind of even maybe the courage or their own sense of grounded self to like continually approach the conversation. But it's important to punch through that, again, for me, when I would say something like being a homesteader is being a reactionary, I believe that, you know, there's like an essential reactionary ethos to being a homesteader. And so I'm always trying to help people punch through some of that cultural programming that comes through our institutions and other places, and kind of like question the various modern narratives of pluralism and what, you know, no limits are good, you know, no hierarchy is good. These are all very base things. And people's, when you talk to people about this, they're not very put together on these issues. You know, they're just kind of like this like mantra repeating about, you know, these various lines that we're all kind of familiar with them. And so thank you for giving me the opportunity to have this dialogue with me and like coming back to it, even though triggered or whatever. I think it is good. And that's what I am doing. I'm triggering people. I'm confronting a programming, and I'm doing it from like confronting a program, which, you know, and I'm doing it from a vantage point where I don't have the cultural weight behind me. You know, I'm the weirdo or the asshole or the outsider, you know, in most situations. And so,
I'm glad we had this conversation. I was frankly dreading it beforehand, but I'm glad we had this conversation. And yeah. I think I understand where you're coming from a little bit better. And there are certain things that I will, you know, dwell on and consider. So I think
we covered a lot of ground. That's for sure.
Yeah. God bless you both.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Mike. Thanks a bunch.
Right on, man. Have a good one.
All right, have a good night, guys. Take care.